This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is an edited recording of the panel session from the recent BFM Health and Living Live 2017 by AIA Vitality. This event is presented by AIA, the real life company.
We now come to arguably the most exciting session, the age of the sex drought. I want to tell a very personal story to share with you guys. I am 32 years old, and against all odds, I am married. And recently, my wife tried to spice things up, okay? And that never happened. So she came up to me, and she's like, it was at night, about 11 p.m. She said, hey, baby, would you like to have tea, coffee, or me? And my response was, yeah, I could go for some me right now. And then she was like, hey, yeah, I also feel like having some me, lah. So we both went out, we had me, mama, we came back, we forgot about sex. It's the best night ever. Okay, so if you and your partner are not having sex, does that mean your relationship is dead? Yes. No, actually, no. So sorry, off script. So apparently there's a new kind of sex drought, the one that is brought on by modern life. The good news is, there is a way to go around it. Now, before we go on with the speakers, let's watch a very special video about this subject. Please enjoy.
How would you personally rate the importance of sex in a marriage from 1 to 10?
Personally, I will score 8 out of 10.
Maybe an 8.
1 to 10. I think it could be 8.
Oh, I would rate it around 7 maybe. 7.
A lot of couples, after they reach a certain milestone, not so much age, but maybe when they have kids,
career developments, we have mortgages to pay, we have kids to look after and so on and so forth.
Definitely the frequency or the opportunities dip.
Too much sex is like every day, I guess, for the rest of your life, obviously. Too little sex, I would say,
you know, very few times in a year, I guess.
A balance, maybe once or twice a week. Yeah, I think that's keeping it real.
Your partner have needs, you have needs, and you gotta work that out, right? But at the same time,
it's not so much an age thing for me at this point in time. But
one of the factors, maybe, because if you're also sick, then probably it might affect you in a certain way.
Due to the tiredness, lack of desire, so it would probably, you know, wouldn't encourage us to have more sex.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, on that note, please help us welcome on stage our speakers for today. We have Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist from Gleneagles Kuala Lumpur. We have Martha Lee, clinical sexologist, Eros Coaching. We have Paul J, consultant clinical psychologist, Monash University, Malaysia, and Paul J, psychology consultancy. And of course, we have our moderators, the always sexy Meera Sivasodhi and Sharad Kutan.
Okay, George is here at last. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is the session which I have been worried about, I have to admit, because I have some uncontrollable people on this panel. Sharad, I asked Sharad to help me, but then I realized that might have been a mistake as well. But, you know, okay, let's get going. I mean, when we talk about sex, intimacy and all of that, I think what I found quite interesting is that nobody wants to talk about it. You want to hear about it, but you yourself don't want to talk about it. And I can never understand why. When you talk about, is sex all about libido and desire? I'm actually going to start with Martha, the sexologist. Martha has come from Singapore. They have big problems there with libido and desire, I understand.
Big round of hands for Martha, guys.
Martha, case study. Okay, how much does libido and desire play in the whole realm of intimacy?
I don't think the libido is the only factor. I think one of the biggest factors is mentioned in the video just now, which is time and opportunity. You may feel like having sex, but if you don't have the time or the space for it, then it's not going to happen. It doesn't mean that you don't want it.
Okay. Paul, how would you define intimacy?
It's a lovely word. If you looked it up in the computer, you'll find a lot of Greek history to it. Very nice philosophy behind that word. But the root word as a verb, intimate also means opening and sharing. I'm intimating something. I'm sharing with you. I'm doing things openly. And another psychological word that goes with that concept is making yourself vulnerable. I think in good, healthy sex and good, healthy intimacy, you're both vulnerable. You're not holding back, you're not holding guns, you're not holding daggers behind your back, but you are free and easy and you're actually letting go. So intimacy, no doubt, which is a biopsychosocial issue, but there is contextual issues and there are spiritual issues as well. But you wanting to do it or wanting to be intimate is crucial. That need, that emotional drive is basic to intimacy.
How much is it is physical, how much is it is emotional?
They say the biggest sex organ is the brain. And I say no, it's the mind. The brain is a whole bunch of neuro stuff that works, but the mind is the biggest sex organ, and I think a lot of it is psychological because it's very emotional. Emotions could be a heightened level of emotion that you possess to drive this behavior, or total lack of it, so you go looking for it.
George, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, interestingly, you talk about intimacy, right? Okay. I mean, sometimes when it comes to patients who come to see me, intimacy is not just that physical act of sex. It's about relationship. And I quite like the way you say that it's about vulnerability. In fact, it's also about trust. You know, it's about trusting each other, partners trusting each other, that I would like to share relationship, your emotion, your most vulnerable part of your body, you don't mind being judged, it's because we're sharing everything. And that's a crucial part of sexual relationship that I think we need to look into.
I can see Martha frowning. These are coming from the men.
Yeah, I can't help frowning because in my work, when I contribute articles to the media, sometimes they take out my word sex and they replace it with physical intimacy. And actually, I meant sex. And physical intimacy can mean so many things.
Such
as? It
can
be a cuddle, it can be a snuggle, it can be a kiss, it can be touch, it can be holding hands. And I think our society is quite uncomfortable with
the
mention of sex. And so I get really furious about that. So when you ask about intimacy, I think it's great that Paul already mentioned it's definitely much more than just sex. That's the emotional, there's the vulnerability, there's the trust that needs to take place. I think a lot of my male clients don't really get that. Mm. It's like all systems ready, I have an erection, can go. What are you talking about? Get into the mood.
You know, when you use the word sex, it's a huge continuum, you know. Intimacy and sex doesn't necessarily have to involve sexual intercourse. You can get far more intimate without just the intercourse.
Mira, I wanted to ask you, I know I've been brought on for comic relief, but I'm going to get serious. I really have no idea what I'm doing up here.
Happens a lot in sex. People don't.
Sex in the City, basically, is my question. What is the question of sex related to the general theme of the city and urban living? I mean, we have, if you talk about time and opportunity, we have perhaps don't have much time, but we have huge opportunities. Urban, you know, living means we are up against so many people, which is, you know, X number of times, you know, in terms of opportunities. So what is the relationship between sex and the city in this discussion?
Modern life, really.
I'm in private practice. I work with people with sex problems, and they're not having enough sex. They come to see me.
So what is enough?
Yeah, that's the...
In Singapore.
According to their partner, it's not enough. My clients say that they're not having enough sex. So then I ask them, what do you think you need to be doing to have more sex? And the answer is frequently, oh, maybe I should get a vibrator. I know maybe it's not so available here in Malaysia. You can come to Singapore. But the thing is, in modern day living, everyone is so busy, tired, stressed. And when I ask them, what do you think you need to be doing? Their first answer usually is, get a sex toy. So what they are actually saying in an indirect way is that they need to be pushing themselves harder. They need to try harder and then you'll get results. And that means you will have more sex. And what's actually happening is these people are tired, they're stressed, they're anxious, and that's why they're not having sex. So the issue is not pushing yourself harder because you are probably at breaking point.
Yeah.
The commercial world has driven us to this now. Modernization has made complete strangers of people. They've made strangers out of couples. They've dehumanized us because of the work and the stresses and things. And you come home feeling, I'm not human. You know, I need to become human again, and I've got no time for sex. It's not a priority. But it's commercialization that's actually driven us to this point of strangers at home.
Well, I've got an example to give. If I give my patients who suffers from erectile dysfunction some medications and say, look, try this. In 2 weeks' time, we have a consultation and see whether you suffer from any side effects and whether it's efficacious. And they will say, 2 weeks is not enough. It's like, why is that? It's because my wife works outstation, I'm here, and then, you know, then we have all these dinner parties and that sort of thing. You're right, Sharad. In the modern life, that spontaneity that our parents enjoy, that sort of relationship that I enjoy, probably is a luxury we can't afford these days.
And also, I think in those days, there wasn't any television. And
people don't watch televisions anymore, right?
People don't watch television.
Oh, yeah, but they're looking at their smartphones.
No, the smartphones. So we're going to probably come to that. Okay. Yeah. Now, coming back to the question about, like, modern day, I ask you, what is enough sex? So a typical Malaysian having sex before age of 40 and after age of 40. Do you have any clue?
I would think that they'd be wanting to do it every day, but then I might be wrong.
Mira, do you want to answer that?
No, I'm not.
Can we answer that
this
on behalf of a woman?
No.
Well, you can say my friend.
This is an edited recording of the panel session from the recent BFM Health and Living Live 2017 by AIA Vitality. This event is presented by AIA, the real life company.
There's decades of research that show the link between the arrival of children and satisfaction in a relationship. And often they say that sex doesn't become spontaneous to the woman. Is that a contributing factor? I mean, we talk about stress, we talk about modern life, but then now you have the children coming along, and that affects the whole intimacy thing as well. Martha, what do you think?
Yeah. So I think I'm the only one answering questions seriously here.
What were you expecting?
Because you're from Singapore. You're from Singapore, because you probably get arrested or fined for not answering questions.
In Singapore, we're quite serious, and it is true that I think culturally we put a lot of the responsibilities of childbearing, the child rearing and the education. And so when someone is busy, tired, they are just not in the mood. They feel that they've given so much to the family, and sex becomes just another thing that they're expected to do, to perform. And so they try to come up with excuses. And they may not admit it, but these are excuses a lot of the times. So I would say that there are two kinds of people. I'm not sure whether Paul and George, you know about this. There's a spontaneous desire response, and then there's a responsive desire response. So spontaneous people, just like introverts and extroverts, spontaneous people are people who get hard, want to go. And responsive people need to have the touch and intimacy in order to feel like having sex in their bodies. And women generally are more responsive. And if they're not being touched, they're not having the intimacy, whether it's physical, emotional, or mental, they are less likely to feel like wanting to have sex. And generally, women are also less likely to initiate sex because of that.
Okay, and in all of this mix, I mean, the woman goes to work, she comes back, she manages the home, she, you know, does everything. And then I'm reading here that in all of this, the man wants to know that his wife desires him. That's another chore. How do we do that all at one
on
go?
Top of all that multitasking?
Yes. You want to be desired.
Is that too much to ask?
Absolutely.
Is it too much work? Has sex become hard work for so many people?
This issue of women being spontaneous, my point of view is that for ages, women have been conditioned to be more emotional, or men have been conditioned to be less emotional. And I think society and our cultural contexts actually determine how spontaneously expressive we can be about certain issues. I don't see a gender difference in terms of spontaneity. It's purely conditional, and it can be learned. So we are here to teach and for you to learn, or for me to learn new things about being sexual. So I think it's a learned issue
rather than...
So how do you learn it, Martha?
I feel that when it comes to having more skills, then you have confidence. And then from there, be able to have options to choose from, like different techniques. And I feel it is true that women are givers, and they are conditioned to be a little bit more withholding. They don't want to come across as too forward. So it is very much the cultural programming that we have. I feel that women are capable of being spontaneous as well, but I feel that there are also tendencies, and you can't generalize all men are extroverts and all women are withdrawn. It's not true, but generally, I do see a lot of that in my clients.
Okay, any questions from the floor?
It's yes. Very interesting session. My questions are, I'm seeing cases as a counselor, I'm seeing cases in my office where the newly married couples, they are losing out their sex desire, men complaining that the wife is not interested in sexual intercourse, and at the same time, the wife is complaining that my husband not interested in sexual intercourse. So this is very common among the young people, young, newly married for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, among these couples. And also it becomes very serious issues, and then it affects their marriage, and it creates a conflicted marriage, and even they go up to the level of divorcing each other. So what is the reason? Is it emotional factors involved for the sex desire of men and women, or any other things is involved? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Who wants to take that very quickly?
Okay, I feel that a lot of times when you first get together, that's when you are on your best behavior. And when the honeymoon phase is over, that's when we fall into what I consider bad habits. And once you've been with someone for a while, there are certain relationship patterns or tendencies that starts to happen. And then when they're not making an effort, it's less likely to happen. At that point of maybe 1 year or 2 year mark, usually they start feeling bored about sex. That's when you have sex, but you're doing it in the same way. So what's so fun about having sex in the same way? So you start filling up your time with other things that are more interesting and more important, but not necessarily comfortable with actually admitting that it would be maybe interesting to do things in a slightly different way. So it's still the same thing, still having sex, but how do you do it in a different way? So one of the things that I suggest to my clients a lot is to just do one thing different every time you have sex. So take responsibility for if you find that sex is boring, that you find yourself getting into routine. So take ownership that it's not just something that you do for your partner, it's something that you are also doing because it feels good, that you like it, that you want it. And you want to be able to have a good relationship, not just with regards to only sex.
Is it that important? Is it possible for us to just become asexual beings and enjoy all kinds of things? I mean, playing Nintendo together, going for a, you know, MPO concert. Why is sex so... Why we place sex as an important thing that needs therapy and intervention, couldn't we just be happy asexual?
I think it's possible. As you progress throughout the lifespan, different priorities are reset, values change, and it may not be as satisfying or may not be a priority for you to be engaged in that activity to show your love or intimacy with someone else. So you could take that factor out of that equation. On the other hand, if it is part of the equation and still is and expected to be, then it becomes a symptom of that relationship. It describes something happening in that whole pattern. And to answer the gentleman's question, sometimes this kind of asexual behavior or problematic issues are symptoms of the relationship. So it may not be a sexual problem. It could be a problem of the marriage and communication. It could be problems of illusions and disillusions, and disenchantment, expectations.
You know, those romance novels have created so much problems.
Well, just
really.
To add to that, yeah. The questions, I mean, it's good that the couples go and see that counselor, because in Malaysia, we don't have that sort of communication. And clearly, these couple wanted help. I mean, I always tell couples that, you know, sex is like nurturing a plant. If you actually don't water it, the plant will die eventually. And I mean, there are many, many relationships. You know, some of our parents actually sleep in different bedrooms for a long, long time. But the thing is that that relationship, it's just never gelled in together at how it used to be. So if that is that partnership that is happening, many people accept it. But that also can create cracks in relationships, and then that will lead to divorce, like what was suggested by that counselor. So it is not a problem until it becomes symptomatic in that relationship.
Question.
Hi, I'm Sabrina. I'm a rehab physician, and I feel that unless the doctor initiates the question, the patients don't feel that they are given permission to ask. So a lot of people who come to me are from the Asian background, and religion is part and parcel of our upbringing. So usually their first sexual encounter is their marriage. And the expectation is on the first night, you know what to do. Until the first year, you know what to do. You should know what to do. So how do we go about this? Educating our public that it is okay to talk about it, and whom do we ask? Because a lot of my colleagues, they are not comfortable to be asked such questions.
Well, I agree with that sort of approach, because even in medical school, sex education is very, very low down. So how do you open up that conversation? Because after all, you're going into a doctor's consultation to meet somebody that you don't really know that well. And suddenly you have to open up all the intimate details in the bedrooms with this person. So as a doctor, every time I see a patient, let's say has got prostate problems or has got urinary tract infections, I will ask very routine questions like, how is your weight? How's your bowel habit? How's your appetite? How's the sex drive? And then the first time they actually get really anxious, like, why is he asking about my sex lab?
Really? Well, that's all you talk about.
No, right,
on radio,
it's
everywhere.
Right, it's true, right? Okay, so they probably don't get too surprised, you know, because, you know, if you come to see Dr. George, you just get interrogated about how often you have sex. But the thing is that as a doctor opens up opportunities, open up that door for them, one day they feel ready, then they'll come and talk to you. I really think that is a very important way of opening up opportunities for patients to discuss it.
Cultures, Paul, I think that plays a huge role in how we perceive sex. And you're right. I mean, nobody told me what to do on the first night. There was no internet then. So that's rather of concern, because, you know, look up culture one. Number two, pornography. Our children now are so exposed to pornography. Are we saying that that's what sex and intimacy is all about, if that's their first encounter as far as information is concerned, Paul?
There's a danger about... One, the biggest danger for me in pornography is the ability for people to answer questions from children who watch pornography. That is one big problem for me. Watching pornography in itself, it's neutral. But what happens to the mind and the questions that the mind begins to ask, it needs replies. It needs proper answers. And for that, we need a very comfortable situation where the children can see pornography, accidentally even, and then ask questions openly about it. Now, you need that setting. Culturally, I think it's going to be difficult to change the present status of sexual intimacy now. But if you as a family now practice this as a regular part of your developmental curriculum at home, where you talk sex, you're open to sex talk with your children, you watch movies and say, why is the door suddenly shut? What do you think they're doing at the back? And if you talk these things now, it'll be a lot better. We've talked about our first night with both my daughters already, because just it arose at some stage. And creating that culture is important. The other aspect about pornography is that it sets different standards. So if you see something happening on screen, you think, oh, this is sex. And that defines your next moment when you're in practice. So you think that that's the standard and that's the norm. The danger is that the children are watching things that are not the norm. And then it becomes their norm, and then they want to practice it. And it's not their fault. Now, who monitors this information? Who audits this information that the children have? It's got to be you. We cannot stop access to pornography, but you have to provide the opportunity like this to actually say, let's talk, let's be open. That's when culture changes. Culture will not change silently. We suffer in silence, but culture needs discussion.
I wonder though, you know, we often characterize traditional societies as being prudish and conservative. But I also know that in terms of when we talk about Asian patients, you say, I mean, Asia is very sexual. We have the Kama Sutra. We have the, I don't know, the Tao.
Asian women. Yeah.
You know, we also have a culture of aphrodisiacs. I mean, if, what is that about, right? So perhaps the issue here is also a very gendered way of looking at sex. So men will talk to other men about aphrodisiacs because it's about sexual prowess, right? It's about the male ego. It's not about your relationship to a woman. It's about your relationship to other men, you know? And I think similarly for women, women might talk to each other about sex, but maybe with heterosexual relations, the communication's not going across the gender divide. Oh, am I got it wrong?
We are always talking about how we have to pay attention to the male and make him feel desired on top of everything else.
I'm seeing a lot of uncles and aunties here. I wonder when was the last time they actually stopped and talked about sex between the two of them. And if I'm holding my wife's hand as a granddad and grandma, the children say, what are you both up to? Stop it. You know, it's our culture and we've drawn the barriers. I think a lot of this is self-imposed.
Okay, body image, Martha. I'm sure a lot of women have body image issues.
And men.
And men, really. You have body image issues,
yeah.
George?
Okay.
It's quite surprising to some people, for instance, if they've gone through breast cancer and they've had their breast removed. And it really doesn't matter how you have sex. It's very important to have fun while you're doing it. Being lighthearted about it, being open about it, being the person who starts the conversation, even if you are with a partner who is not open to it, can start some spirit of goodwill going, so much so that the opening starts to happen slowly. I didn't have any coaching. I didn't have the internet growing up. But I knew I was starting to get bored with sex. So I decided that I would ask my partner for feedback every time we have sex. Because how am I going to get better if I don't ask for feedback? And gradually... that's how I got better.
Is it a questionnaire?
Oh, sorry. Okay. So I had three questions. I always ask these three questions. And I made it lighthearted. So the first question is, how was it? And I say, okay. And I'll ask, what was good about it? What did you like about it? And then the next thing I will ask them is, what will make it better? What do you think we should try the next time? And then slowly, because this woman never stops asking, slowly the conversation actually started to open up a little bit more. And they turned around and started asking me what I liked. And I was like, I just wanted to be better. I didn't think about what I wanted. And that's actually how I started becoming more and more confident and comfortable talking about sex. So all of us can do it.
In fact, that's a really good point. In the consultations, when you have... most of the time, you only have the men coming to see me and they refuse to come together with their wives. And then they usually will say things like, you know, I've got prostate problem. Then eventually they will start talking about this. So if you ask them, when was the last time you actually asked your partner what you enjoy and what you don't enjoy? And then they begin to say, never. It's like, you know, to have a situation like what Martha was talking about, that feedback, you even don't communicate with each other to say what hurts and what doesn't hurt. You know, so that's a very important point.
Yeah, so stop blaming your partner and say, your partner, this. Take charge and say, this is what I want. This is what I would like to make better. And start your little bit of coaching, you know.
Not really.
Yeah, to ask.
I'm taking notes. I have to go back and carry out this feedback system going here. We have a question.
I'm studying occupational therapy and we mainly deal with activities of daily living and that includes sex. So I just wanted to ask, usually for people who fall into depression, and since we're talking about urban living, so mental illness and all this happens very, very often, and as well as like amputation and all kinds of diseases that just drops the sex drive. So how do we help patients like that?
So they have got conditions that actually compromise them, you know. In fact, one of the situations is like, you know, I always get asked whether it's the medical condition that actually caused them to have problems or the lack of sex that actually caused them to have problems. Let's don't talk about amputation and that sort of things first. Let's talk about associations with decreased libido and erectile dysfunction. These are associated with metabolic syndrome. These are associated with with diabetes, these are associated with depression and high blood pressure, cholesterol, and so on and so forth. They are closely linked with each other. So for us, as a doctor, to see these patients is a perfect opportunity to screen them, to find out how we can help them to improve the situation. So health, enhancing their health will enhance their lifestyle. So when we get a situation like that lady who is occupational therapist seeing patients who, let's say, had amputations or have body disfigurements or something like that, to engage in this, the most important thing, actually, first of all, to see them together, the couples together, and actually see how they can achieve that intimacy. You know, it doesn't have to start with sex first. It can start with the touching. It can start with the conversation. And then when you proceed from there, then you can embark on the penetrative sex per se, but it doesn't have to get there. It can start with intimacy.
For this occupational therapist, you can look at sensate focus as a model in which you can guide your clients through it, in which is progressive touch.
Can you elaborate a little bit about sensate focus?
Okay, sensate focus, basically you do touch without involving the genitals first, the private parts. So that's phase one. And then phase two, when you become comfortable with that, you incorporate genital touch. And then phase three, when you are comfortable with genital touch, then you go into penetrative sex. Because if you've gone through a major illness and health condition, probably you are not mentally, physically prepared for sex. Maybe you are afraid that your body is not going to respond the way it used to. So by breaking it down into smaller steps, it's less intimidating, and you don't need to go to a sexologist or sex expert or psychologist to be able to make such simple suggestions to your clients.
People are getting so hung up on this idea of intercourse. You don't need to have sexual intercourse. You can be intimate within foreplay. It is an end in itself. And I'm very interested in this word. I shared it with Meera. Why do we call it foreplay? It's not like three play, five play, six play. But it is F-O-R-E, before play. And it's got historical significance that sex is supposed to be fun. And when it's fun, it becomes even more pleasurable, and there's give and take. And then there is after play, which is so important. We are all hung up on this in and out business. But the fact is, there's so much more to it than just that. No, it's got to be fun.
So there's foreplay, there's play, and then there's after play. And then you can also have inner play and outer play. Everything can be play.
Well, I'm learning a lot of things.
Sounds like a lot of drama here.
This is an edited recording of the panel session from the recent BFM Health and Living Live 2017 by AIA Vitality. This event is presented by AIA, the real life company.
Pornhub, which is actually a porn site, they carried out a survey, and it was quite shocking that the Malaysian women were ranked 7th in the world actually accessing porn on our mobile phones. My question is, what does that say about the Malaysian man?
I was expecting, what does it say about Malaysian women?
Why are we even accessing this on our phone?
I'm guessing that the men are busy trying to get sex, not just watching it.
Get sex from somewhere else.
Somewhere.
Okay. Can I have a slide that up? You didn't know about this.
No, I didn't know about this.
This is a Malaysian data to show. Before 40 years old, the mean frequency is 9.1 times. And then after 40 years old, for men, actually it dropped to 7.6 times. For women, before 40 years old, it's 6.8 times, and it goes up to 8. So everyone assumed that, you know, in Asian culture, you know, you saw the clips from earlier on, you know, Crystal was talking about there are 1,000 other things to deal with.
Sure. This is 8 per week, month?
Per month. Per day. Right, okay. In your household. Okay. So what it tells us is that, you know, actually the frequency of intercourse, because if you look at this, we're talking about average of twice a week, right? Okay. And then even for 7.6 time, it's actually twice a week. But for women, people always assume when you are perimenopausal, you're not interested anymore and that
pregnant.
Sort of thing. But maybe that reflects many women because they feel like society has doomed them to non-sexual behavior, and therefore they need to have some degree of outlet, and maybe access, porn site might be something of an outlet. I don't know. What do you think?
What was the sample of the study?
I wouldn't know, actually.
Well, this is a study that was actually commissioned by Pfizer. It's a global better sexual survey. This particular one, right?
The Pornhub one, I'm not sure.
In Malaysia, we have 200 men and 200 women each arm. And then globally, there were about 8,000 people, and Malaysia is one of them. And in Singapore, it's half of this, the frequency. In Japan, it's half of Singapore, right? Okay, so, you know, so we're rank in the middle. If I just show you this is the kind of like ranking of sex, right? Okay, so women, you know, if you can see Malaysia rank in the middle of it, Japan is way, way down. And then Singapore is kind of like, you know, similar to Malaysia. And then for men, it again, Singapore and Malaysia, it's kind of roughly in the middle. And that just shows that the ranking of what they think is important. Early on, you ask your BFM staff, where do they rank priority? All of them say 8 out of 10, 8 out of 10.
They lied, okay?
In reality, this is Malaysian men, right? They rank work and career, gaining wisdom, financial well-being, physical health, family life, being a spouse, partner, spirituality, and being a parent, a lot, lot higher than sex. It's ranked 8 out of 17. When you look at women, Malaysian women, it's ranked 14 out of 17. And then, you know, it's all about being a spouse, family life, and then being parents, love and romance, all that meals and boons and then everything. And then only later on, it put it down. And it's because society has actually determined that, you know, it's because other things are more important. And that's the reason why there is that crack in the relationship when it comes to sexual health.
How important is sex to a relationship? I mean, is there a physiological issue? Is something happening in your brain when you have sex with your partner that makes sex actually not having sex a problem for a relationship?
From the clinical psych point of view, if you've never had sex, you wouldn't know it's not happening to you. But if you've had sex, your brain knows something. It is very good for the brain. It's very good for your gush of hormones. It's very good for neuroplasticity. And the more sensorial, and my closing words were going to be, your sex has got to be multi-sensorial. Use all the senses and bring in spirituality too. Once it's sensorial, electrical impulses are going up to the brain. The brain is affecting other hormones, and then the medicine man will tell you. And it's good for you. It kind of, you must look up the literature that defines orgasm. And it talks about the process of orgasm. It's very neurological, physiological, and very strongly, positively psychological. So it's good for you. And that is why some of us in the open era, we will talk about self-stimulatory sexual behavior, like masturbation for any gender type. But it's actually good for you. Sex is good for you. It is prescriptive. It's like a vitamin sometimes. You know, take it to prevent other havoc things happening.
He's very passionate about
that. He is very passionate.
So what you're saying is that you don't know what you're missing until you really have it back.
So this asexual behavior, I mean, opposed to, apart from people who are kind of born or naturally disposed to being asexual, for those who have been sexual, a lack of sex becomes a problem. Is that how, would that be correct?
Just reorganize those words. Having more sex is good.
Having more sex. Always. But everything else being equal.
If I hear you correctly, what you're saying is that it's okay being dormant sexually for a while. But when you have that back again, you suddenly realize that what you're missing, all that time with all the endorphin and all the feel-good factors and all the relationship trust and everything. Is that true? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, I am.
Sorry, you have a question.
Do you think there is a difference between desire and lust when you're having sex?
Desire and lust.
Yeah.
Is there a difference?
Martha? Every point to Martha. Desire and lust.
To me, desire means you want to have sex. And lust means...
You have to have sex.
To me, lust means you're salivating over something. An object, a person. So the salivation and the that's external and the internal is the way I would differentiate it.
Yeah. I have a question on behalf of the women here, and I know a lot of people don't talk about the women and their needs when it comes to sex. How important is an orgasm to a woman?
A lot of women are not having orgasms when they have sex. I know women who fake it just to get it over with. And
is that really true? Like,
yeah, it's true. Yeah, yeah. And it's been, it's recently there was this article that came out that said that a lot of times the orgasm is not for the women, it's for the men. It's about the male masculinity and the ego. It makes the man feel good when you have an orgasm, when the woman has an orgasm. And a lot of women don't have orgasms. It's because the foreplay or the play or the afterplay is just rushed. And so they're not feeling excited or aroused enough to be able to have an orgasm. Women generally need more time. Generally, it's been proven research to be about 15 to 30 minutes of stimulation before they can have an orgasm. So then the man who is worried about his erection is rushing the process. And so that this causes problems with the ability of the woman to get an orgasm.
And I've had many occasions, many workshops where women can't describe an orgasm because they haven't had it. It's important that if you explore your body, you will realize what is good, what is not good, what is nice, what is not nice. And then you actually share that with someone who can help you attain that.
There are many types of orgasms, penetrative sex orgasm, clitoral orgasm, there's also cervical orgasm, there's G-spot orgasm, there's nipple orgasm, there's all kinds of different orgasms that's possible in the body, and it's unfortunate that we have so little sex education, then understand what we like, and then be able to communicate this with our partners.
Okay, fantastic. We're running out of time. George, I'm going to ask you to conclude.
To conclude... Well, I still don't know what to do with urbanization.
It does. You are stressed.
Yeah, you're stressed.
These are ways
okay.
in which you can
Well,
improve.
I think I like the doctor's questions about how do we introduce this to patients. I really think that this is an area that there's a lot of barriers, a lot of stigma, and there's a lot of need still to talk about it. And a show like this will always kind of like lowers the barriers, but, you know, we all have a little bit of fun and then we go home. But at the end of the day, if the culture doesn't change, it's difficult. And I think really start with your partner. You know, this is your lifelong partner. Start the communication. And then I really think communication is the key to intimacy that will lead to a great sexual relationship.
Thank you very much. Paul J., Martha Lee, Dr. George Lee. Thank you all very
Thank
much.
You.
This is an edited recording of the panel session from the recent BFM Health and Living Live 2017 by AIA Vitality. This event is presented by AIA, the real life company.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.